Hello, and welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. My friend Heather Principe has been described as a journey woman of the old ways. She studied classical yoga and polarity therapy, which is based on yoga. She was chosen by Cree Native American healer Don Cardinal to learn the tribe's wisdom and the sweat lodge ceremony, a rare sharing with someone not born in the tribe. She's dedicated to teaching within the paradigm of the four directions and the five elements, and her work weaves these ancient teachings into a contemporary outlook on science, personal growth, and society. Heather founded the Yoga and Polarity Center in Malvern, New York. She also serves on the board of International Polarity Education Alliance and the International Polarity Board in Switzerland. She has taught at the International Seminary for Interfaith Studies, the Southwest Institute of Healing Arts, Shivananda Yoga Ashram, and Interfaith Ministers. Heather co-authored Ahimsa in Communication with Diana Slattery. Wendy has studied extensively with Heather and now teaches polarity therapy in her program. I got to study in Heather's program, Journey of the 13 Moons, and we talk a bit about that and many other things in this special conversation. Heather is a great teacher of teachers and students, and I'm truly honored to bring her to you on this episode. Enjoy. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Peter.
So glad to be with you here in Oceanside.
Thrilled that you're here with me, that you came all this way to do this.
Have a chat. Well, having a chat with you is always worth it.
Same here.
Thanks. So I mentioned in your bio that you have a variety of practices that you draw on and history of working from different traditions and from different teachers. And before we got on air here, we started talking a little bit about history and context and what having a little bit of history in mind as we're looking at what's going on today could be useful. And it's not always happening.
I had an interesting exchange this week, as I was telling you earlier, with someone who is on the opposite end of their self-identified political stance that I am. And I don't think it really matters where you identify yourself if you have an ability to listen to all possible voices and all ideas and all thoughts. And I tend to take those things more seriously if people understand their context, our context in history. So for me, it's really important, really, really important. And I think that being said, that so many people look to the two traditions that I follow. I follow yoga, not as a religion, but as a way. Mm-hmm. And I follow Native American, not specifically Cree, ceremonial traditions as an underpinning to all my work, which allows me to be less reactive. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, it's not that I don't have the reaction. I may initially have a reaction, but then I put it in context within my life and then within the lives of my ancestral background and hopefully within what's coming for my grandchildren. So that I understand the impact of everything I do and how it relates to the larger community. So it's really, for me, context is everything. We don't live in this bubble. We don't live in this moment where everything is only of the moment itself and not of the time before. Right. We are human beings who have a history of being.
Right.
And yoga and the practice, ceremonial practices also help you to slow down and to make relationship to that.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. Whatever that is. I mean, even that last word you just said, is. Like, there's so much disagreement with is right now. What is? well, when I'm like, what is? How can you know, yeah. It is.
And if an alien were to land here from another planet and see, and I'm sure they're doing it every day, but if they were to land here and not have a context within which to put this, it would only be what is. It right. wouldn't be what was.
Right.
You know, oral tradition is very powerful because in oral tradition, the grandparents and the great-grandparents tell the stories in circles to their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren in some cases. And when that happens, there's this relational thing that happens. It's an ancestral relational thing that happens that puts every generation within a larger context. Mm. And they don't feel so disconnected from one another. But because we've lost that in this culture, our context is so small.
Right.
So and if an alien landed into a tribal community where the context was larger, then the alien would have less trouble understanding what I'm talking about here than if he landed just here. Because people, I look around at people I know and love, and they're missing their family of origin. They don't have siblings close by that they can be with and speak to. If we were to have one big electromagnetic pulse that discontinued all the flights and all the technology, who would be near their tribe? No one. And when I say that, of course, you'd be near your friends and the people that you loved, but maybe. You wouldn't be near your origin.
Right, right.
And, you know, again, that makes a really big difference to how we see our contextual past, present, future.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a large now. It's a very tiny now.
Yeah, and I think part of it is this notion of the story that you use the ancestral oral tradition passing of story as one contrast point. Right now, it's like anybody can invent any story because the bubble of listening is so small.
Yes.
So we're not even able to relate because there's no common tale. There's no common framing. There's no common facts.
And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Is the now is so tiny. And in 2 weeks, we will forget the now for a new now. And that's very different than living mindfully in the present.
Mm-hmm.
That's living nearly unmindfully in the present.
Yeah.
So whatever thoughts flying around that day, everyone wants to attach to, your agenda can attach to that. And then you can project everything onto that one thought or cull everything from that one thought to build a larger, shall I say, opining...
Yes.
Diatribe.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter which side of the fence you're sitting on because the general underpinning of it all is anger and not having a larger context.
Yeah.
Most of us just have a very limited way of seeing the now.
Right. And indignation is like the main response.
Well, anger. It's the most of our culture is afraid of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our culture is afraid of both anger and sadness. We don't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And we reconcile everything with our thought body. And it just creates story after story. It's like the person who comes in and starts telling them a story and suddenly you don't know what story you're on anymore. Mm-hmm. You're on 15 stories, but you have no way to trace them back.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to slow them down and say, what are we talking
about?
How do we
get here? Right.
How do we get here from there?
Right.
Yeah. It's like that.
Yeah.
In general, in our society and in our political culture.
Yeah.
And in our culture in general. There's no, it's nearly as if we're suffering from pandemic ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And because of our disconnect from our origin and because of our disconnect from our tribe and our now being so tiny, we just bounce from thought to thought and thing to thing.
Right.
Without any awareness.
Right. So, luckily, some folks are working on that.
Yeah. And we all have, listen, if we're doing yoga now, or we're doing some kind of ceremony, or we're doing something with a sadhana, you know, like a practice of our own, we have a better chance as a society in general.
Yeah.
So, this whole movement of getting mindfulness into the classroom, it rocks my world. It's just that the people teaching mindfulness are sometimes some of the most fractured people I've ever seen. I've started to notice what's out there teaching mindfulness, and I think,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, we've got great words and we've got great ideas. We just don't necessarily have the actual underpinning that we need. We've lost something.
Yeah.
I tell people to invoke their grandparents.
Yeah, I was going to say something that's similar, which is that the teachers who have a longer sadhana is what's required, not just someone who just learned something, then presenting it as a done deal.
Yep. So. A practice, a lifetime practice. Like, what have you been doing all your life that supported you?
Yeah.
What did your grandmother do every day that supported her? What did your great-grandmother do every day that supported her?
Yeah.
My daughter and I talk about this all the time. She's nursing her 3-year-old and her 6-month-old in tandem and getting a lot of flack about it. The comments range from you're creating a monster to, you know, how are you doing that? Yeah. You're making yourself sick. You're making your 3-year-old not right. And her response is, as long as he needs what he needs as a baby, if I give him that, he'll grow into a secure adult.
Yeah.
And he'll be able to face the world because he had his mother.
Yeah.
And that's what a mother does initially.
Yeah.
So that, again, that sounds like a crazy thing, but she's not giving up on that. And it is in her way, her sadhana. She was nursed by me. My mother didn't nurse me. And my mother's mother nursed all her children.
Yeah.
So we lost that generation.
Mm-hmm.
We lost one generation, and it was an enormous loss for all of us.
Yeah.
What did come during that time was during that loss of that generation from, the 1930s to the 70s, a lot of the East came West to bring the teachings from the East. So we may have lost it in our practice body, but we got it in our mental body. Now, if we can marry those two back into the culture by practicing now what has become a focus of our mental body. Yoga is very big in our culture now. If we can take it back on as a way, we have a chance. That's my hope.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I mean, I see more and more. You know, I've only been teaching teacher training for 10 years, but I started practicing more than 30 years ago. So for me, it was a way of staying sane and doing all that stuff. But I've been able to watch this transition from where we were nervous about talking about things like meditation to trainees, to the point where now we have still some of this residual language in our manual and whatnot about, you may feel that it's awkward to talk about meditation, but basically everybody in the training is at the studio because we teach meditation. So that's a beautiful thing to see.
It brings up a great story for me. I went to a chanting, on Fridays we just have a chanting hour that people can come to. When we'll sometimes chant the sutras, we'll sometimes just chant whatever anybody brings in to that they want to chant, and maybe 6 of us, maybe 10 of us, depends on the morning. We get together at 7:30, and one morning, Face walks in, who I have know that I know from somewhere. And she walks up to me and reintroduces herself. And I said, I worked in your gym many years ago teaching a meditation and chanting. And you made me stop because you told me that people couldn't clear their minds, that the devil would come in. And she said, Heather, I've come a long way thanks to the fact that you planted some seeds here. She fired me, actually.
Oh, wow.
I was fired from that gym because she was... Her religion told her that you can't clear your mind and make it blank. The devil could come into that space. And I said, you know, the world has come
along. The idle mind is the devil's playground.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the saying?
Yeah, it's like that. Like that. You know, the Calvinistic slash whatever it is.
Yeah.
But anyway, she said to me, I'm so grateful for those days that you came because it was seeds planted. That was 22 years ago. She said, it was seeds planted, and then you opened your studio. It was the first yoga studio on the South Shore here. We had one on the North Shore, and that we were 2 studios in all of Nassau County. And she said, and I remember not coming to your studio because I was so ashamed that I ever said that.
Wow.
And then I went into the city to study. She went to Laughing Lotus.
Uh-huh.
So, but it was funny to me, all these years later, to realize, yes, something is changing. Like, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal.
If you can get one person to realize that you can't empty your mind anyway, that it's going to think its thoughts, and that you have control over that mind, at least the thinking mind, the conscious thinking mind. You have control over that through breath. And she just then went on to expound, and we talked for another hour and a half, and I was so excited. I said, you know what? These seeds have been good. They have planted seeds, and they've been good in the world. So that's
And you
helpful.
Have to trust that, right? That it's coming through you. That's your place and your reason to be here, and what comes through is the right stuff. You know? And that's exciting. Well, Alan and I are writing a book about meditation that's targeted at people who have either been practicing mindfulness or they've heard about mindfulness and they're intrigued about what there is beyond mindfulness. So that's been a fun project.
Nice. Yeah. That must be exciting to work with Alan.
Yeah, it's really good. It's good. Nice. He has a very informal way of working that's mostly conversation, and I write.
I get all the psychology because I need CEUs for certain things. I get all the psychology bulletins from the PESI Institute, and every other one these days is about mindfulness in the classroom, mindfulness in the workplace, mindfulness, teaching mindfulness to your clients. And so now I'm seeing that come through. And I remember teaching it in the classroom many years ago when I was a teacher. I spent a very small part of my life thinking that I wanted to do that until I realized that the public school was no place for me, even as an adult. So I was trying to teach mindfulness to the children then and meditation in a very simplistic form, in silence. I was actually teaching them Plains Indian Sign Language, but they wanted to speak, and gave them, I think it was 92 vocabulary words that were really necessities during a day. And we were silent for 2 hours in an afternoon, just using the signs with one another and learning how to be very conscious of what our impulses were, you know? And they were 8 and 9 years old, these kids.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But you know what? That was a seed. Again, another seed. And now it's in the classroom. So I get excited about little things that I see and realize that my walk on this earth is a short one and that I'm not going to get to see too much. I just have to keep doing it and having no attachment to outcome.
Yeah.
You know?
Pure Gita.
Pure Gita.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, doing anything else is just frustration.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean not engaging all the way.
Oh, absolutely.
In whatever is in front of
you.
If you're
going to do it, do it.
Yeah. Yeah. All I want for Christmas is for you to sponsor me on Patreon. Just kidding, Santa. I also want John Coltrane's Love Supreme on vinyl. Could you elaborate a little on the silence practice that you teach as part of the 13 Moons training?
Yeah. Well, we do something called Journey of 13 Moons. I do it here at my home. I do it every other year, and I'm actually doing it outside of here this year. And we meet once a month. And one of the journeys that has to be taken by the participants is that they have to spend 24 hours in silence, but that includes not using technology of any kind. Not writing, not reading, not looking at television, and just being in silence. And then their next journey is to be in silence with three other participants of the group. They find that a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of challenge around that way of being silent with one another. They think of all kinds of ways to be not silent in there. They get very activated.
Yeah, I experienced that.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch that. And there are not any rules except to not engage in externals. It's really what it's about. It's interesting to notice that people often come and say, well, I was able to do it for 9 hours and then I couldn't do it for 24. I had to answer the phone. It was for work. My children needed me. They needed. So my words are always, well, you see what pulls you out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your power leak. That's where you're leaking power in your life. The first thing that pulls you out, the first thing that you make an excuse to rip you out of your ability to just be in your space.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of how your power leaks in your life.
Right.
And once you have that awareness, then all the other awarenesses start to come. And that is true svadhyaya. That's mm-hmm. the true beginning of the ability to see yourself and to teach yourself mm-hmm. who you are.
Yeah. Start seeing your patterns. And
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always say to people, you're not really practicing svadhyaya until you're able to be in silence with yourself for prescribed and lengthening periods of time.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I one of the things I really appreciate about all of the different work you do is that you meet that meditation place with this svadhyaya component mm-hmm. so strong, like mm-hmm. not just wipe it away and find silence mm-hmm. or do a technique and it goes away, mm-hmm. but to engage with it, like you were saying earlier, we don't like to feel suffering or we don't like to feel sadness or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You engage with that
yeah.
stuff
yeah. yeah,
as part of your practice.
Well, you have to. Otherwise, you're not living a real life.
Yeah.
You know, life is about sadness. It's about anger. It's about frustration and confusion. It's about angst. It's about fear. Those are all those parts of the human condition. And once you try to medicate out or cull out or change the human being into something it's not, you're now an artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. really.
Right. Or suppressing a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, you're suppressing and it will winnow out. We, you know, in this country alone, we talk constantly about autism. And I think so many people talk about the fact that it's a true belief that our inoculations and their components of the inoculations are causing it. And I kind of beg to differ. I think that we now are on our third generation of giving people anti-anxiety medication and anti-depression medication. We're three generations from the first Dexies. We used to call them Dexies for speed.
Mm-hmm.
And then our Valium component, which we were calming everybody down.
Right.
So about three, maybe four, post-industrially, maybe four generations of us have been trying to get rid of our emotional response to an unbalanced life.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to... Our DNA is starting to morph. So I believe that autism is really a disconnection from the emotional body, that our fascia is probably just getting more and more rigid. Connective tissue is getting more and more rigid. There are probably all kinds of change in our brainstem. Because of this winnowing out, you know, in the Native American tradition, we teach that, you know, each generation has a way of altering all the generations, the seven before them, the six before them, and the six after them. Well, we're altering ourselves mm-hmm. physiologically. It's a complete worldwide
yeah.
phenomenon
yeah.
of changing our DNA.
Yeah. I've heard you say that in the past when doing the medicine wheel work,
yes.
that, you know, seven generations out, the issues that you're dealing with are now in your
yes.
DNA.
Yes,
and that's
they are.
Such an amazing concept.
Yeah. Well, as above, so below, yeah. as within, so without, and everything is dynamic. We are changing generationally, and we're changing generationally, mentally, emotionally, and physically.
Mm-hmm.
On a continuing basis.
Yeah.
It's always changing. We're
right.
always shifting.
We're in the evolution of the universe.
Absolutely.
As part of it.
The osteogenic process
mm-hmm.
of the evolutionary imperative. I just made that up.
Love it. It's in your new book title.
Yes. No one will buy that book.
Well, that can be the subtitle and that'd be something really catchy with sexy on the top. You know?
There you go.
There you go. Excellent. So to talk about that silence thing from another place, which is where often the yoga practices come from. There's this practice, Mauna, of silence, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been practicing that with Al for, I don't know, maybe just since we moved to Ishta. I don't remember him ever having that as a practice before that he used. But then he used it in a Tsongkhapa meditation where we were going to try to come up with something. So during some certain part of it, we were silent for some period of time. So I did a little research, and almost many of the things that are in Ishta lineage come out of Shivananda. Mm-hmm. So I was reading, I think, Shivananda's commentary on that practice, and it was beautiful about the voice and the ideas and the linkage between speaking and idea, which is a fire thing, right? So it's like creating a spark that then keeps the wheels going. Mm-hmm. It was quite a beautiful image.
Keeps the wheels going, and can you do that in silence?
Yeah.
You'll notice, if you're very generative in your thoughts and you think a lot and you're actively participating with others, the thoughts take on a very subjective, centered process. If you are alone and away from people for a little while, they take a very objective process. And then you start to see the difference between those two things, and you can start creating thoughts.
Can you say more about what those two different things are?
Yeah, one is an external factor, one's more internal factor as it relates to the external. If you stay in silence long enough, and I always think this about Vision Quest on the fourth day, if you stay in silence long enough, the physical discomfort and the mental discomfort and the emotional discomfort you feel start to dwindle, and something else begins to come up, and it's so deeply related to your spiritual process and to your spiritual walk here. It relates way more to your beingness in this human incarnation. Mm-hmm. And that goes, it is neither subjective nor objective. Now it becomes completely the spirit that walks with you, having thoughts that are inspirations, like I always think that the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna are like Arjuna being on his fourth day laying there on the field, you know?
Yeah.
And finally, Krishna's words are coming from inside of him and not outside of him. Well, of course they are the entire time. But he starts realizing it in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And, or at least that's my imagining. That's my wish imagining.
Well, it's,
they're coming from an internal place, and he's understanding that I can imagine him rising up on that fourth day, or maybe the beginning of the fifth day, off of that field and saying, I'm here to do what I'm here to do, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it with gusto.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter what I do, just as long as I do it. Gandhi said it in one sentence, what you do may seem unimportant, and in Arjuna's case, may seem against all things that you believe in, but it's important that you do it. If you're not silent, you can never figure it out what it is that you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You can't even get close to that. And you'll flagellate yourself with the subjective / objective imaginings of what you're supposed to be doing in somebody else's imagination.
Right.
Because you're not given all the possible choices. As a child, was I given all the possible choices? No. At 9 years old, if I hadn't seen my uncle practicing Tai Chi and yoga on his little platform next to his... Did I know that choice existed until that moment? No.
Right.
Just saying.
Yeah.
You have to know what all the choices
are
there.
Yeah, I had to wait 24 years to see any of that.
Right.
I had to move to California, where the weird people lived.
Right. But in silence, as an adult, if you've never had all the choices, you start realizing there are other choices.
Uh-huh.
But you have to be in silence long enough. You have to be able to say, you know, nothing I'm doing is working for me. Nothing that I am doing in my life is working for me.
Yeah.
I need to find something else. And trust me, when I say this, it's a long journey from that place of realization to actually finding is what you're supposed to be doing. But there'd be a lot more happy people if they could just get silent a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. I watched the Orthodox practice of the Jews. And there's silence and there's a disconnect from all technological, nearly Amish disconnect from all technological functioning one day a week. And the ones that cheat, so many of my friends that I know have been through that life and reject it because of that.
Yeah.
But the ones who still practice it have a silence and a generative process that's very different than the rest of us.
Mm.
A very successful generative process. The ones that practice just once a week, just unplugging.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be religious,
right,
but it's really important for us.
Right.
So important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's going to make its way out of this new craze of doing things, whether it's, you know, some app is making you do it or whatever, you're going to take a moment.
My app made me do it.
You're going to take a moment and stop and do something. All I want for Christmas is for you to rate Peter's podcast on your phone or on iTunes.
Just kidding, Santa. I still want a 3D Sri Yantra pendant.
Yeah, I've been doing a little research on gratitude for the script that I'm writing for an app for some company I work for sometimes. And yeah, it's amazing. It's like, you know, these things that are available that just take this little bit of effort and have such profound impact. And yet, coming out of the generation that we came out of, that was like not there.
Right, right.
I mean, things were so ritualized by that point in the religions we were practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one thing that sustained within the Catholic upbringing that I had was this sense of like kindness, not stealing, not harming, you know, things that we think of as yamas niyamas, but that were in Ten Commandments, and just the spirit of that was still alive, at least in my family.
Yeah. Let me say, that being said, I think most of it, because we're in, you have to understand, there's so much to look at. Catholicism is not just Catholicism. Catholicism in America is Catholicism laid on top of Puritan.
Yay, we're back to history.
You know, we're back to a context.
Yeah.
So if you're a Catholic in, say, Zurich, and you've never, it's very different than being a Catholic in Cleveland. It is. Because there are different social mores and taboos. There is a whole different cultural underpinning of the socioeconomic, political country that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different. I always say that this country can't continue very much longer as a one country because everyone wants New York and California to float out to sea.
Yeah.
That sounds like it might not be a very bad idea.
I know.
Like, I think New York might be able to be its own country.
I became
country.
A states' rights person in the last few years.
Right, exactly. So how do you imagine it is with different countries? It's just so. So being a Catholic or being a Protestant in one place is very different than being in another. You know, we have this Calvinistic thing that has nothing to do with Catholicism. Never did. But there's this Calvinistic thing that's come to us from the 15, 1600s that's, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, it's better to give than to receive. You can earn God. I mean, I don't know a Catholic in the United States says that doesn't believe that with enough rosaries and Hail Marys, they can't believe you earn God.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a completely Protestant belief.
Mm.
So, you know, look, again, it's all context. It's all context. And go back to silence, until you're silenced, you don't really know what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
Until you can practice that as part of your self-study, as part of your self-awareness. To me, you know, we talk about Santosha, and we talk about tapas. You can't ignite tapas with somebody else's candle or with a match. You must ignite tapas from the inner side. And your gratitude and peace of mind is only cultivated when you're clean. And clean isn't just the sausha of washing your face and combing your hair. It's the cleanliness of the mind and the ability to say, okay, I'm having all these thoughts and they're valid in some reactive way. But what is my intention for this day in my life? And if you just can set your intention up when you get up in the morning, it's going to change everything. Not what your reaction is to the coffee machine's not working, or the heat wasn't warm enough in the room, or my blankets fell off during the morning, or my partner's not doing what they're supposed to do. What is it just for you to clean up your mind the minute you wake up? Because you had all those thoughts that you weren't aware of during the night, and you wake up in some kind of a state. So sausha is not just washing your face, it's washing your mind.
Yeah.
And that comes from that moment of silence that you take alone in the mornings. The only time that I think sausha and santosha are really a struggle is for young mothers.
Right.
And even then, the act of nursing your child, which we've gotten away from in the generations, gives you that moment of peace. True, deep peace that allows you to see what you're thinking and have that cleanliness of mind and that gratitude for being in the world and being able to suckle a child. And so, you know, we're so disconnected from ourselves. It's hard to imagine that this is going to be an easy road back, even if it's, you know, if it's possible.
Yeah.
But for those of us who need it and want it, it can only be found in the disciplines. And the disciplines have to be self. They can't be, you can't go to the ashram and learn discipline. You can be beaten to death and you can be subject, you can learn to be subjugated into chop wood, carry water. But can you come back into your life and chop wood and carry water?
Right.
You know, all born in silence.
Yeah.
All born in silence.
Yeah. It sets the contrast for you to be able to examine what's in front of you and know what to do. Mm-hmm. That was a moment of silence.
We connected there a minute.
Yeah. The silence we emphasize in our Ishta practice is meditation itself, you know, to do work with pranayama, work with visualization, kriya, that you're pointing your focus at energy lines so that you're like moving around that manas mind, the sensory mind, and allowing for an awareness of that stuff. But the state, you know, it was nice that you said nursing. It's like coming to that different state, you know, and to be there and let that silent time happen. And then the samyama of being in between is such a fruitful spot for then knowing how to move forward. So, yeah.
I always marvel at the mentality, how we have created such a mental practice of yoga, and how when these young people come in to, you know, I taught yoga teacher training for 20 years. I'm still involved in a few here. But I always marvel at the young people and how they really relate to everything through their mentality. They study everything through their mentality. And the actual experiencing of that silence is so visceral. You can't think yourself to silence.
Yeah.
You can physically experience pause and ease. Like a few minutes ago, you and I had a silent moment.
Yeah. I'm still in it.
Yeah. And I'm a little tranced out. And I know that you are as well. We had, but there was a moment, a silent and deep moment where we're using a lot of words, but you know what I'm talking about, and I felt it, and you felt it. And that's what counts.
Right.
In between people. I don't know too many people who can have silence between them.
Yeah.
And just allow it to be there.
Yeah. And maybe you can add to this if I'm not grasping it the way that you think about it, but you mentioned, you know, people stilling their mind earlier on, and I think so many people get frustrated with meditation because they think they're supposed to be some kind of a silence that's, you know, utterly without anything in it. And in my own experience, it is that, you use the word visceral, you feel a shift that's taking place, and you feel different in the way that I still feel sitting across from the table with you right now. It's like we're in a different zone.
Yes.
But there still are things going on.
Yes.
It's not like we went to went to the moon suddenly, where there is no air moving or anything.
Yeah, there's a lot still going on. But now we're connected in a different way, because I'm not just talking to a microphone and to possible people who might listen to this podcast.
Right.
I'm speaking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're here together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what counts. You know, I'm listening to your experiences, too, as you're talking. And that's meaningful to me, knowing how you've learned and how you understand silence and the experience of it. And I just got something that I didn't know before about you. And I've known you a little while now,
mm-hmm.
So that was nice.
Yeah.
And it's even nicer to just stay in it a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, there was a song by Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel called The Sounds of Silence.
Mm.
And I was thinking, and I used to listen to it a lot when it first came out. I guess I was about 17 or 18 years old when that song came out. The Sounds of Silence. And I think without ever knowing it, they talked about the constant vibratory quality of all life force. Because even within the space, there is vibration. Like it's occurring around the space. In polarity, we would say, if you could truly be in the ether, then you can experience all the elements without actually having to be activated by them. You can be in this space without, and the vibration, without being of the vibration. And I think that's what it boils down to. Do you remember about 5 years ago, you said, meet me at Italy, and we met there, and we
mm-hmm.
had an espresso.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there with you, and it was really interesting, and I wondered why I was there. And it was just you wanting to connect. And I think I got that within the first few minutes. It was a great, bustling place. I think it was in the late fall. It was around this time of year, maybe a little earlier. And I remember thinking, okay, I can let go of Peter's agenda, because the only agenda is to make a relationship, is to connect.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember the way the foam looked, because I didn't end up having an espresso. I had a cappuccino.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember the way the foam looked. And I could say in this moment that for me is presence in any given moment. If you can remember something about the moment,
mm-hmm.
that's profound. And my cup had an S in it.
Huh.
It had like it was shaded S. And I kept it in my memory because I thought someday that I would understand the meaning of the S in the cup. I've never really thought about it again until every once in a while I see you and I think about that moment. That's the side benefit of silence.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say nearly the shamanic benefit of silence.
Mm-hmm. All words that end start with S.
It starts with an S.
Silence,
yes,
shamanic.
Silence, shamanic. There's something about your awareness of everything around you in that moment that allows you to see, not with an agenda in mind or with a purpose for what you're seeing, but just to fix a reality in your mind so that you learn something from it. I also remember when you left that day, and I remember the door you went out, and I remember standing there for another minute because I went back into Italy to cross over to 23rd Street. Oh, actually, you went out the 23rd Street side. I went out the door on Broadway. Is it Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
Or closer to Broadway. And I remember stopping and I was going to buy something and I didn't. And then continued out the door and then just stood on the street for a minute smelling the air. And I remember that as well. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that there are many moments in my life that I can tell you all my felt senses and my smells, they seem to be my connection into something deeper. It's not nearly like in that moment I create between myself and that other person like an umbilical cord of sorts or an energetic cord.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been connected since that day in a different way than we were connected previous to that. And it was about the S in my cappuccino and the smell and this present sense of my standing on Broadway in that moment. And I know that right now that place is vibrating in the world.
Yeah.
With that, with my active memory. You may not understand what I'm talking about, but that's my experience of deep presence and yoga.
Yeah.
Because I think that if it's present in everything you do, every meeting you have, every relationship you have, your relationships don't have to be often and they don't have to be active to be present and to be valuable.
Yeah.
I said a lot just then, but I don't even know what I said.
Yeah. No.
But it all comes from silence.
Mean, yeah, it's like describing the Kaivalya Pada of the Yoga Sutras. It's like when you tap into your yoga, things feel like this.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's, it's so wonderful to hear you use just like colloquial kinds of language to say it because it can seem so highfalutin.
Well, that's the trouble with yoga. I'm teaching yamas and niyamas next week and I'm never going to open their book and I'm going to tell them to close their books.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just going to go through it in 3 hours
mm-hmm.
in a colloquial, relatively relational way that makes it accessible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with people who study beyond in yoga. I didn't really study that until I'd already met with Don and I started mm-hmm. going into Rig Veda and started saying, well, this is much easier because I felt this. Mm-hmm. I've been this. I've lived this.
Yeah.
This has been an experience I've had.
Yeah.
You know, that's look, I've been so lucky in my life to have such a heaven to earth relationship with my two teachers. I mean, my three teachers, really. But what I learned at their feet and in their presence was all in silence or in vibration. For John, it was vibration, and Don, it was silence. And that always brings me back, always, always, always brings me back to my sense of vibrational relationship to the earth first, that heaven to earth connection, and then to everything else. Because I can't be with you until I can be with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no me to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
There's an extension of you, but there's no me.
Cool.
Thank you for listening to me today.
Of course. Thank you for sharing. Yeah, I was speaking with a student earlier today. We were doing a treatment and also talking about this you, me, it, that, you know, we're also making those distinctions. We're this swirling mass of energy and love, call it what you will. And it's, I think, important that people have this the visceral experience that you're describing to help bust out of these bubbles that we're constructing.
Yeah.
In our world.
Yeah. The next time you have a meeting with a parent, a child, a cousin, a friend, just feel yourself in that moment. And you'll be connecting with that other human in ways that you never imagined. Mm-hmm. And it will change something.
Mm-hmm.
Deeply change something for you and them.
Yeah.
Everything becomes rich then.
Yeah.
Don leaned over to me. Don was my native teacher, my Cree native teacher, and I worked with him for a number of years. Sometimes for a very long, intense period, sometimes for just short bursts over time. And he looked at me once. He was teaching me how to take people on Vision Quest, and I was complaining about the way we were walking. I said, "We're not walking east, we're walking southeast." And he said to me, "Just follow me." And I said, "But we're walking southeast. We're not going to meet up with them again. We walked due west, and now we're walking due southeast." And he turned around and he looked at me for 10 minutes, very silent. And he said, "I haven't told you this before. You talk too much. Follow me." And he was giving me a choice to follow him or go away. Uh-huh. I followed him. Huh. I'm glad. And I started to listen to all my mind chatter.
Yeah.
And when I say mind chatter, I've always had an active mind. I've always had a fertile mind. I read incessantly. By the way, he wouldn't let me read or write for a year. Wow. I wasn't allowed to read or write for a full year. That was very hard for me. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest thing I ever did. Mm-hmm. But it was part of my new sadhana. And now I realize for me to really be okay, I got to spend some time in that silent place. I can't go there. And you know, the phones have taken over since those days.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to just push it away and say, no. Not in the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go. It doesn't matter what happens. Not now. And young people today don't know what life is without a phone.
Right.
Or an ATM. Right. You had to wait till Monday to get your
$5. Right. Right.
Now you can walk up to anything and get whatever resources that you have, and everything is so right there, right yeah. now.
If you can use your dinner, phone to pay for things.
Yeah, you can just get yeah. your wallet, have your wallet on your
Apple
phone.
Apple Pay, Venmo, yeah.
Christmas shopping in one afternoon. Yeah, it's yeah. all on your computer. Yeah. It's such a different world.
Yeah.
And the people who are my age and who are here and have recognition that is different have... They go many ways. Many of them have become very rigid and don't want to know about technology mm. and have a flip phone still, and mm-hmm. they really don't want to. And then I'm always wanting to be a part of what is now, but it can't keep up because my mind is more visceral. Mm-hmm. I'm more connected. But if I can find the right words and find the right way, and I think that's why I most appreciate this today. You've just helped me to get to that place of describing that. And without that disconnect from technology, you can never really have those moments.
Yeah.
And I wonder about look at my grandchildren playing with the phones every day. Yeah. And will they have that ability to disconnect from that and be here? Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting possibility here. You've given me some food for thought.
Yeah. Well, it's, I'm sure similar to the way things have been going on forever, mm-hmm. you know, we just have our new variants of the challenges that are trying to keep us lured into the dance of life, the play, so that we stay mm-hmm. enough to make it all worth happening. Yeah. And yet, there's always been this way that we can also get the perspective.
Yes, perspective.
And the real goal of life isn't like how many buildings or millions can we accomplish, but can we make that connection back?
The connection.
Yeah.
It's the connection.
So that we know, and then this becomes just this thing that we do.
Yeah.
And then it could be fun. It could be at least interesting or full of wonder, even when it's hard.
Yeah, that's so true. Full of wonder, mm-hmm. even if it's hard.
Yeah.
Challenging things are just, challenges are meant to be met.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's why we get them. That's yeah. why they're here.
And a big piece of that tapas is to take them on and mm-hmm. not lose your shit over it, you know. Mm-hmm. But
Or lose your shit and know that you've lost it.
Yeah, yeah. And then do something after
right,
that.
Because,
of course,
else.
You can't squelch it in the moment.
You know, for me, it's not, we all lose our shit. I mean, I would say to people, perfection is never the goal. Mm-hmm. The goal is to do the best you can in the moment and then take that moment to build in a learning for the next moment. That's it.
Right.
So the best we can do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely been something I've been working on.
We all do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
This was nice. We should do this without the microphones.
Yeah.
Lots more.
Well, I'm glad we had this excuse then.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Since we haven't pulled it off very often. So.
Thank you. All Namaste.
Right. Namaste. Beautiful. All I want for Christmas is for you to support me on Patreon.
But hey, Santa, I'd still take peace on Earth.
That's our episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Heather. I sure did. Talk to you soon. Have a wonderful week. Namaste.